Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, from knowledge to action. Over the weekend of June 9th, over 4,000 activists gathered in Chicago for the People's Summit. Organizers described the summit as a convening of organizations and individuals committed to social, racial, and economic justice, committed to a different kind of agenda. A people's agenda based on popular demands for justice, equality, and freedom. Speakers ranged from Bernie Sanders to Nina Turner to Van Jones to Josh Fox and others. Sojourner Truth was represented at the summit, and today we bring you the first in a series covering the summit. You will hear panelists, actor and activist Mr. Danny Glover, Dr. Jane Sanders, educator and wife of Bernie Sanders, and author and environmentalist Naomi Klein, and Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation magazine. You'll hear about each of their personal journeys into activism, about taking inspiration from progressive movements across the globe, about the legacies of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, W.E.B. Du Bois, and other civil rights greats, about the ills of corporate media, and about the path forward in the era of Trump. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Donald Trump is taking to Twitter to denounce reports that the Russia investigation is widening to examine whether he tried to obstruct justice. The Washington Post reported late yesterday that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is seeking to interview three Trump administration officials who were not involved in Trump's campaign. Those officials are Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, Michael Rogers, the head of the National Security Agency, and Richard Leggett, the former NSA Deputy Director. Accusations of obstruction arose last month when Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. Comey told Congress last week he believed he was fired because of the Russia investigation. In two tweets early this morning, Trump said, "They made up a phony collusion with the Russian story, found zero proof, so now they go for obstruction of justice on the phony story. Nice." A second tweet, quote, "You are witnessing the single greatest witch hunt in American political history, led by some very bad and conflicted people." In a related development, Republican Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Charles Grassley said his panel will investigate Comey's firing and any alleged improper partisan interference in law enforcement investigations. The business of the House resumes today, a day after 66-year-old James Hodgkinson opened fire on Republican lawmakers practicing for a charity baseball game. The attack critically wounded House GOP Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana. It also injured two Capitol Police officers and a current and a former congressional aide. Hodgkinson died by return fire. Donald Trump addressed the nation shortly after the mass shooting.
After 7 a.m. this morning, a gunman opened fire on members of Congress and their staffs as they were practicing for tomorrow's annual charity baseball game. Authorities are continuing to investigate the crime, and the assailant has now died from his injuries.
The baseball game will go forward today. Former presidential candidate and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said on the Senate floor the shooter apparently was a volunteer for his campaign last year. Sanders denounced the violence.
Just been informed that the alleged shooter at the Republican baseball practice this morning is someone who apparently volunteered on my presidential campaign. I am sickened by this despicable act, and let me be as clear as I can be. Violence of any kind is unacceptable in our society, and I condemn this action in the strongest possible terms.
Hodgkinson had spoken out against income inequality. He was from Illinois, but had been in the Alexandria, Virginia area since March, living out of his van. A few hours later, across the country in San Francisco, a workplace shooting left four United Parcel Service workers dead, the shooter and three victims. 38-year-old Jimmy Lamb opened fire during a workplace meeting. Lamb reportedly had filed a grievance over having to work excessive overtime. According to the Mass Shooting Tracker website, the incidents in Alexandria and San Francisco were the 195th and 196th mass shootings of the year. The group defines mass shootings as those in which at least four people, including the assailant, are shot. A federal judge has ordered the Army Corps of Engineers to redo an environmental report on the Dakota Access oil pipeline. Federal Judge James Boasberg said the environmental impact report did not adequately consider the possible impacts of an oil spill where the pipeline passes under the Missouri River. Boasberg said in his 91-page decision that the Corps failed to take into account how a spill might affect fishing rights, hunting rights, or environmental justice, or the degree to which the pipeline's effects are likely to be highly controversial. Judge Boasberg said he'll consider later whether the pipeline must halt operations in the meantime. It was a rare legal win for opponents of the pipeline. Dave Archambault, chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which has led opposition to the pipeline, called it a significant victory. British Prime Minister Theresa May has ordered a full public inquiry into the high-rise fire in West London. May made the decision today shortly after making a private visit to the site where at least 17 people died. Authorities warn the death toll could rise as entire families are still missing. Fire Commissioner Danny Cotton said specially trained cadaver dogs would start searching the 24-story building.
We are going to utilize some specialist dog training teams that we have in conjunction with the Metropolitan Police that will go through the building and the surrounding area looking for any identification of people. They're specially trained dogs, and they will be used first of all.
I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, again bringing you this show from home. I'm still a bit under the weather. Today, we're bringing you part of a panel discussion called From Knowledge to Action, recorded at the 2017 People's Summit, which took place in Chicago over the weekend of June 9th. You'll hear the voices of author Naomi Klein, journalist Katrina Van Den Hovel, and author and activist Mr. Danny Glover. But first, we'll hear from the moderator of the panel, Jane Sanders, longtime educator and wife of Bernie Sanders. Let's go now to Jane Sanders.
So we'll start with a two-part question. What I'd like to know is if you could tell us a little bit about what led you to become the progressive leaders that you are, and also, what are the issues that you're facing that you're most interested in today's world? I know the media covers certain issues over and over and over and over again, and not too much about the issues that we feel are extremely relevant to our democracy. So, Naomi said she'd go first.
Sold me out, that's unbelievable. So I guess to answer this question of what placed me on my journey, I always feel a bit weird about it, because it doesn't entirely feel like a road that I chose out of some great act of courage or insight on my part. I grew up in a really political family, and my grandfather was a political artist, a revolutionary artist, who was blacklisted for his activism, including his union activism. He helped organize the first strike at Walt Disney. and so he lost his job, he lost his ability to do the work that he loved. And hearing those stories as a kid shaped me. It taught me that there are consequences for taking a stand. And my parents were war resistors, Vietnam War resistors. And we moved to Canada because at the time, Canada was what the first Prime Minister Trudeau called a refuge from militarism. And tens of thousands of American war resistors came to Canada because, like my father, they didn't want to be part of war crimes. And so I grew up hearing these stories of struggle, these stories of actions having consequences, of attempts to live one's belief. You know, and I'm also keenly aware that there was also a tremendous amount of privilege in my family's experience, that it was the war resistors were welcomed in Canada in large part because many of them were middle class, white, highly educated, were seen as an economic asset by the Canadian government. But there's still a very sharp difference between the way the war resistors in the 60s were welcomed and what we have now, which is a prime minister who, you know, sends out memes saying refugees welcome, but meanwhile we have indefinite detention of immigrants, and we have not repealed the Safe Third Country Agreement, which still defines the United States as a safe country. So it means that if you try to seek asylum in the U.S., you can't then seek asylum in Canada. So, you know, I know sometimes it's nice to imagine that everything is fine north of the border, but we've got our own branding prime minister who is responding to many problems with marketing instead of substance. So this shaped me, but my father likes to say that we came to Canada because of the war, but we stayed because of the universal public health care. and so for me, having this dual identity, I mean, literally having dual citizenship and growing up kind of on both sides of the border, because my whole extended family was in the United States. It was just my parents that came to Canada. It really shaped my thinking because, you know, our countries are very similar on a surface level, but there are real differences when you make these decisions as a society to say the basics are going to be covered, healthcare, education, right? And make a decision like not only should there be well, it's not free anymore, but genuine free public post-secondary education, but we're not going to allow private universities so that there can't be a system where the wealthy opt out of the public sphere and it's then allowed to erode. And also the decision to invest in public broadcasting so that there is public interest media that tries to knit a country together. So there are flaws in all of this. You know, Indigenous communities still don't have the most basic services like clean water, let alone adequate health care and access to education. But seeing the way different decisions about the public sphere shaped this country and I think shaped the values of the country really had a big influence on me and put me on the road that I'm on. Yeah, I think we should move on. Yeah,
okay.
We'll tackle the next big question after.
About myself, I too grew up in a political family. My moral compass in many ways was a nurse, my aunt. She was the nurse for Nutley, New Jersey. My grandfather founded a business and helped elect Ronald Reagan, which I think is one of the reasons I do what I do every day at The Nation to counter the destruction. My father was in politics, still strong, ran against John Lindsay, ran against Nelson Rockefeller, ran against Frank Hogan for DA in New York. He didn't win those races, but what he showed me was a commitment to public service that was not transactional. There was a belief system, which Jane has talked about. Candidates, and there's so many transformational candidates at this gathering, are there, as was Bernie Sanders, because they believe in something. And that's what we saw in Britain the other day. We saw in Jeremy Corbyn someone who was authentic, someone who had a belief system that it's about the many, not the few. My father's mentor was a man named Roger Baldwin, who founded the ACLU in 1920. And what Roger Baldwin, he always said to my father, why are you running an electorate? Why don't you do work outside? That's where the real change comes from. So in me is a belief that you need the allies inside, but that real transformative change comes from social movements, comes from those who build. And I think there's a mix in this room, but you need both. So the Nation for me was a political boot camp. I've been with the Nation, feels like 152 years, but it's where I learned that you can challenge a downsized politics of excluded alternatives. And you know, the queen of neoliberalism, Margaret Thatcher, told us there is no alternative. There is an alternative, and you are it, and Bernie Sanders is it, Jeremy Corbyn, and the movements. And that's what moves me every day, not to allow those in the failed establishment, discredited establishment, to tell us that our ideas won't work. Because what we do at the Nation is to make sure that what seems impossible becomes inevitable. And that takes struggle, that takes work, and it takes, you know, the Nation founded by abolitionists. We'll talk a little bit more about history, but abolitionists committed to ending slavery. Martin Luther King was our civil rights correspondent for 6 years, and he first came out against the Vietnam War at a Nation event in February 1967. And what he told us about the triple evils of materialism, racism, and militarism are issues we need to grapple with and that I think about every day, because I go to work believing that journalism, our journalism, leads to change, will lead to a more just, fair, equal country and world. And I'm honored to be with you today. Thank you.
Danny, what makes you who you are, and what are you thinking about right now?
I was just thinking, first of all, it's an honor to be on this stage, to be here, and also be on this stage with these four great women here. I often say that wherever I'm going, wherever I am, then I'm where I am, because my mother didn't pick cotton in September. She went to school in September. And that's a huge historical paradigm shift. But the three influences, first of all, my parents were my ultimate influence, but the three influences on me were my great-grandmother, who was born in 1853, who I got a chance to meet before she died when I was 4 years old. My grandmother, who was born in 1895 and was a midwife in Jefferson County, in Jefferson County in Louisville, Georgia. And my mother, who was born in 1920, who was extraordinary, an extraordinary vision as well. She was the regional president of the Council of Negro Women. Both my parents were postal workers, and so they came to the post office in 1948. So all my life and all their career, I grew up in a union household. And those were major influences with me in who I am. I happen to be, though I spent a great deal of time with my grandparents and my great-grandparents as a child, but I was born and raised in San Francisco, California. I, 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 I still live in the same neighborhood that I've lived in since I was 11 years old in the Haight-Ashbury. And I had the opportunity to be around and to be involved in movements from the African Liberation Support Committee movements to the movement that led to the strike of 1968 at San Francisco State, where students of color and progressive white students and teachers led a 5-month strike that resulted in the first school of ethnic studies in any major college in this country, and is still functioning 47 years later, 48 years later this year. So those are the things. How I got to be an actor, that's, I don't know. Because I thought I was going to be an economist. I worked in community development, in the Office of Community Development, and the Model Cities Program from 1971, from the fall of 1971, until at the end of 1977, and then decided to embark on this career that I'm on now, the journey that I'm on now.
It's interesting, isn't it? When we listen to everybody, there's threads that go through. Everybody talks about their family and the impact that their family has made on them. That's certainly true of me. And I look at my ancestors, doing genealogy lately, learning a little bit about that. But my parents and my children, and even my grandchildren, are influencing me now. And then the second thread is education, what you've learned in various places. And the third is culture and a sense of place. It sounds like where you were at a given time really made a difference, or where your ancestors were. I grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant. I didn't have political parents, but I had I had more of an experiential awakening. My dad fell and hurt himself when I was 2.5, and he was in the hospital the better part of every year for the first 12 years of my life. And my brothers had to quit high school to be able to help support the family. My mom worked, and then she went to secretarial school at night so she could get a better job. And then my brother, who quit high school, decided to become a blacksmith in Brooklyn, of all places. And he ended up doing well. He was a world-class equestrian over time, and he is in the Hall of Fame. But what he did was, when he trained horses with no money at all, this was on a shoestring, $300 from my grandmother, but he made money, and he went, the last time my father was in the hospital when I was 14, he went to the hospital and he said, I want him checked head to toe because there's something else wrong every time. And they said, oh, no, we don't do that. We only take care of the issue at hand. And he said, I do that for my horses. You're going to do that for my father. I will pay cash. He was not in the hospital again for 10 years. And that was my political awakening, that nobody should be because they don't have good enough insurance or they're too poor. So I'm thrilled to be here with people who are fighting for Medicare for all, single payer system.
You just heard a story from Jane Sanders, educator and founding fellow at the Sanders Institute. She, along with Naomi Klein, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Danny Glover, shared their activist backstories as part of a panel discussion at the People's Summit on June 10th, 2017. We'll hear more from them, including their thoughts on today's movements for change, after this short station break.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships, minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs.
And that song was Redemption Song by the late, great Bob Marley. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour, you can subscribe for a free podcast. You can also check us out on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Mississippi. And also on SoundCloud, you'll be able to hear the full recording of the panel From Knowledge to Action. That panel discussion also included Pacifica's own Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! So you'll be able to hear the full panel, including Amy's presentation, on SoundCloud. Now, let's go to hear more excerpts from that panel recorded on June 10th at the second annual People Summit in Chicago. You'll be hearing from Katrina Van Den Heuvel, Naomi Klein, and Danny Glover. But let's begin with a question from moderator Jane Sanders.
We're seeing progressive movements all over the globe and wondering what you think about how we might intersect with them. Why is that happening at this point? It's a global phenomenon. Katrina mentioned Jeremy Corbyn. There are many more. Katrina, you want to take that and expand on that a bit?
We're living through a time of tectonic change and shifts, and I think people are saying enough to austerity, enough to a neoliberalism that has failed millions of people, and that they're, put a name on it or not, but that there's a belief that generosity is greater than greed, that community is greater than division. And across the world, and Danny was talking about this, over time, the left has grown stronger through transnational links. We were talking about the anti-apartheid movement. We're talking now in Europe, you have left parties like Podemos, Die Linke, you have the Corbyn's Labour Party. They are championing ideas that were very central to Bernie Sanders' campaign and that are central to the ascendant progressive wing of our politics. So I think the more we can share and be part of that community, the more powerful. I think there's also a media piece, Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, The Nation. We try to cover what's happening in left communities in Latin America, in Europe, in Africa, and obviously in this country. But I think too often, as I said, we are told that our ideas, which are humane, common sense ideas, are not possible. But when you look out at the world, they are, and part of it, at the root of it, I'll stop, is the establishments everywhere have failed. What comes next is our struggle, because the old order is disappearing or is dying. The new one is not yet born, and in that moment, we are fighting, and we are ascendant. We're seeing possibilities crop up, not just out of the blue, but because of years of organizing, people coming to these ideas. And despite a mainstream media, we report on what is underreported or unreported, what's going on in cities rising across this country. We talked about the mayor, Lumumba. People need to know about Larry Krasner or Christine Pellegrino or the candidates who are winning down ballot. My colleague John Nichols, next issue, a big piece on that. If people don't know, you will mobilize, but not mobilize with as much strength or knowledge as leads to a stronger victory.
Naomi, did you want to add something in terms of international leaders, or do you want to broaden it to talk about leadership in general? What do we need from our leaders? How are we choosing them? Is it the right way? Shouldn't the mission lead instead of the individual celebrity?
Sure, yeah. Well, this is a moment, and it is global, right? What happened in the United States with the Sanders campaign, what just happened in the UK with this complete upset, all of the pundit class, this supposed consensus that the result of the UK election would be an overwhelming mandate for the Tories and a complete wipeout of Jeremy Corbyn because he was supposedly unelectable because his ideas were too radical, because he did not represent these focused group opinions. He had actually taken positions out of passion and belief. Imagine that. And also because he wasn't a traditional and isn't a traditional kind of slick, charismatic politician. So the assumption was, of course, he would just be decimated. And this was proven completely wrong. Another example of this is the surge of Podemos in Spain and taking power, not Podemos officially, but mayoral candidates and municipal movements associated with Podemos in Madrid, in Barcelona, linked directly to social movements. And then in France, another upset with Jean-Luc Mélenchon running on a very radical, progressive left platform, coming within 2 points of bumping Marine Le Pen, the fascist Marine Le Pen, off of the second ballot. Once again, against all the predictions of the pundit class, having rallies of 70,000 people. So the issue is the passion that is being provoked here. And it is the passion not of no, but the passion of yes, of putting positive, transformative ideas on the table. Because the real success of the neoliberal project that we have all been living for four decades, right, was never really to convince us that their cruel ideas of privatization and deregulation and tax cuts for the rich paid for by savaging the public sphere that serves people while massively increasing the structures of incarceration and militarization and war, that these were good ideas, that these were right ideas. That was not the triumph of neoliberalism. The triumph, a real triumph of neoliberalism, was convincing us that our ideas were impossible. So as we have slowly been getting our confidence up, right, the first stage was getting the courage up to say no, no, enough, right? And we heard that no ricochet around the world after 2008, when the neoliberals broke their own rules in plain view of the world and intervened dramatically in the market, right? Forget trickle down. Suddenly there are trillions of dollars to intervene in the market and save people if they are rich enough, right? To save the banks from their own greed. And we all saw it, right? So the spell of neoliberalism broke and people had the courage to say no, to reject, right? But that wasn't enough. Where we really see the momentum is in the next wave, is in these political configurations, sometimes new parties, insurgents, candidates coming forward and breaking the real spell, because now we're seeing that we were lied to, that progressive ideas are popular, that radical ideas are popular, right? Like universal public health care, like free public education for all, like erasing debt for students, like getting to 100% renewable energy in 2 decades as quickly as technology allows and science demands, right? So the intellectual fencing of neoliberalism that has constrained our imagination for 4 decades is lying crumbled on the ground. Anything is possible now, right? What's next? Reparations for slavery and colonialism? worker co-ops as the centerpiece of a democratic economy? Who knows? Let's put our ideas on the table, because we were lied to, and these ideas are popular, and it is urgent. Because it's not just our ideas that are popular, that are surging in this vacuum created by the collapse of the neoliberal intellectual project. It is also fascist ideas that are surging. It is also white supremacist ideas that are surging. It is also climate change denying ideas that are surging. We are in a race against time, right? We have found out in these almost wins that we can win. And if we can win, we must win. We have a moral responsibility to win, right? Because our losses are measured in lives. Our losses are measured in entire countries disappearing beneath the waves. We don't get a do-over on a drowned country, right? We live in this fearsome moment, in this race against time, between these incredibly dangerous ideas, but also the other players in this race are the Earth's atmosphere, the acidifying oceans, our eroding soil. So we, now that we know we can win, we have to win. And the courage of this moment has to involve self-criticism on our part. We are getting closer, but we are not yet winning. Why? Why? We can't just blame others. We can't just say we would have won if we hadn't have been and this hadn't have happened. No. Just like those corporate Democrats can't blame Russia, we can't just blame the corporate Democrats, okay? We also have to admit that the coalitions that have been built on the left have been too white, that too often race and gender and sexuality have felt like an add-on to too many people. We need to build this right from day one. The progressive majority is within reach, but we have to build the tent right from day one, and that is leadership. It means taking leadership from the people who are most impacted, most ravaged by this system. We're seeing the leadership in this room. Now, I don't think this movement knows exactly what the next stage is, so this is a complicated moment, right? We don't know what exactly the strategy is. Is it in or out, right? And who is it? And we have all these questions. I don't have the answers. But what I know is that we can't wait, and that the leadership, I believe, should come in the form of people's platforms, that we need to get together and we need to lay out our yes. And it needs to be inspiring. We need to plant those tent posts of this broad progressive coalition so that whatever the next political configuration is, if it's inside the Democratic Party, if it's outside, if it's both, okay? If whoever the leaders are, we don't know who the leaders are going to be, but that those leaders are held accountable to the movement leaders and the vision that emerges dramatically, democratically, from below. We don't have to wait for saviors to come along and figure this out, because the brilliance is in this room, the brilliance is in the movements, and we need to tell this connective story that says, we're not going to play my crisis is bigger than your crisis. We are going to come up with deeply integrated intersectional solutions that radically bring down emissions while fighting gender and racial inequality and economic inequality. It is possible. The policies are there. The principles have to be front lines first. That means that as we switch from fossil fuels to renewables, renewables should be democratically owned and controlled, and it should be the communities that were most poisoned that are first in line to own and control their own renewable energy projects as a drop in the oceans of reparations for colonialism and slavery, and on and on. Thanks.
Thank you. Danny, you...
When I spoke about movements, certainly the movements of the 20th century, and we can talk about the list of names from Eugene Debs to Emma Goldman to Ida B. Wells, who led an anti-lynching campaign at the end of the 19th century. And those movements that have happened, the anti-apartheid movement, let us not forget what happened in Latin America over the last 20 years. An extraordinary change happened in Latin America, in a sense. And often that change was demonized by the corporate press. Places like Democracy Now! And other, The Nation and everything, were able to report accurately on what's happening in Latin America. Extraordinary things happened. Latin America, where every country had a military dictatorship, and that military dictatorship was overthrown in some way and led to a new democracy. So you had grassroots democracy happening in those particular countries. You can say Venezuela, you can say Brazil, where the Workers' Party in Brazil elevated the life of men and women in Brazil. We've seen examples of that. And yet at the same moment, they were in some sense undermined, and we have to be careful about that. So we have to learn our lessons from everywhere and be careful about that. I'm gonna read something from W.B. Du Bois. W.B. Du Bois published an important book in 1903, The Souls of Black Folks. W.B. Du Bois, one of the founders, along with Ida B. Wells, a journalist, a feminist, a radical, formed the, well, were the founders of the NAACP. And he said at the beginning of the 20th century, the question of the 20th century is the question of the color line. And I'm gonna read his quotes on the 50th anniversary of the release of the Souls of Black Folks in 1953. He says, I still today, as yesterday, I still think today as yesterday that the color line is the great problem of this century. But today I see more clearly than yesterday that back of the problem of race and color lies a greater problem which both obscures and implements it, and that is the fact that so many civilized persons are willing to live in comfort even if the price of this is poverty, ignorance, and disease of the majority of their fellow men. That to maintain this privilege, men have waged war until today. War tends to become universal, continuous, and the excuse for this war continues largely to be color and race. That's real. King talked about it when he said militarism, racism, and materialism. And I think we can't lose sight of that. The question of democracy, the test case of democracy in this country lies around the whole issue of race, period. It always has, it always will be.
I wanted to pick up on something Danny just said, because I was at Riverside Church in April of this year. It was the 50th anniversary of King's speech against the Vietnam War. And I think many of you know that the civil rights community, the establishment, just savaged him for saying that you needed to unite in the fight against militarism, materialism, racism. Reverend Barber, great organizer, Moral Mondays, spoke that day. And I just want to raise, in a spirit of humility, I was struck at this great gathering, there isn't more about war and peace. I think we need to really lay out, again, not just what is imperiled, but what we stand for. And there's a vacuum. America's policing the world, there are bases ringing the world. There's a reflexive interventionism, and there's a crazy military budget which loots the possibility of rebuilding our country. So I just think we would be wise to think hard about what we could do to rebuild. Senator Sanders spoke well about the dangers of regime change as foreign policy. He spoke about the Middle East. But I think this country may not be anti-war, but it is weary of war. It is weary of war without end, endless war. And if there is a through line in the nation's history, it is that empire, military misadventures abroad, toxic for democracy at home. Two last small things. This panel is from knowledge to action. And many of you are educators in your own way, and we were talking last night. Our editorial board member, Eric Foner, great historian of Reconstruction, of slavery, of the Civil War, supported Bernie Sanders. But he wrote me one day and he said, if you have any tie to Senator Sanders, can you tell him, you know, enough with Denmark? How about retrieving our own country's radical tradition? And I think it's important as we think of all the young people, we haven't mentioned young people, who have supported Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, our future, and the next generation, what will they learn? Our history textbooks are homogenized. We need to lay out, it's about Tom Paine, it's about the abolitionists, Ida B. Wells, it's about the populists and the populist platform of 1892, which speaks to a country very similar to ours. It's about Roosevelt and this economic Bill of Rights, that healthcare is a right, housing is a right, education is a right. It's about Eugene Debs, a million votes, and into this moment. So I think to retrieve that history says to those, it's impossible. No, it isn't. We've lived through times like this, and we have seized them. And finally, just a shout out to the progressive, don't love the word infrastructure. If you can come up with a better, less, it's so unsexy. But progressive infrastructure, which is building these victories we're talking about, People's Action, Working Families Party, Progressive Democrats of America, DFA, people on the ground putting their bodies on the line in the trenches, because it's not easy. It's not easy, but I think we're seeing people gathered, and as Naomi said so eloquently, we're close. We're, you know, we're moving. We're moving. We're in motion. And when people are in motion, they get worried. And I think some fear is not the worst thing. And fear not just for the Trumpists, but for Democrats in name only. We need to build a progressive future, a left future. Thank you.
Thank you.
The idea of resistance in itself is the definition is to push back. But within the course of that resistance, where do we find the new narrative of transformation? That's our question. Where do we build the new communities, the ideas, the new communities of love? Where do we build that beloved community that King talked about? So what are we looking at? Resistance is one stage on the road to transformation. Always think about that.
Now we're running out of time. We had a pretty freewheeling conversation, but I think we covered a lot of what we talked about doing. This is just beginning, though. We need to have a lot more conversations like this. What I'd like to do is ask each of our panelists to give us any closing thoughts, anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to address, but you'll have to do it in a minute, minute and a half.
I think the appetite for systemic change is really deep. And you know, we can kind of thank Trump a little bit for helping out with that, because I think what people are seeing, and this ties in, I think, Jane, with this question of education and really understanding where we are in time and space. We need to be the ones who are constantly pointing out that Trump is a system, that he's not some Martian that landed to Earth and everything will be fixed if we get rid of him. He is the culmination of all, and the actualization of all of these incredibly dangerous trends, right? Including the idea that we can leave everything to the market, that business is going to save us, that CEOs and billionaires are going to fix everything. I mean, and then he stands before the American people and says his one qualification for being president is being rich, right? So we need to put him in context, right? And we need to say that we need to get at the root causes that made Trump possible. That is our job, not just getting rid of Trump, but getting rid of the root causes that made him possible. And the people are out there, they're seeing this. They're saying a system that could produce this presidency, this corporate coup, right? A market that could cheer his election. A media that could cheer his cruise missiles ordered over chocolate cake, right? A corporate America that can line up behind him. People are going, realizing they don't want any part of a system like that, right? So we need to depersonalize that and get at the root causes. And those of you who know my work a little bit know that I've spent a lot of time focusing on dangerous things that happen during moments of crisis and shock. And Chicago knows all about this because you've got a mayor who likes to take advantage of crises, right? He once said, never let a crisis go to waste. And he's waged war on this city's schools. And he's waged war on everything that is good in this city in the name of crisis. And as bad as what we have seen from the Trump administration is, we have to remember that what we are dealing with so far is just the crises that they have created themselves. Imagine what they'll do with the real external shock. Moments of crises test us. We either fall apart or we grow up really fast and we find reserves of strength and we transform. We are going to be tested in the years to come. We have not seen the worst yet that this government is capable of. So we need to have our plan in place. We need to have our yes in place when they try to ram through their wish list of the most dangerous, violent policies, when they try to use crisis to start new wars. We have to have our plan ready. In times of crisis, we either fall apart or we grow up fast. So let's choose that second option. Thank you, everyone.
Katrina? Last year, I coined a term called media malpractice. That campaign was defined by media malpractice. How many seconds did they give to Bernie Sanders? And in one of the debates, he asked about national security. Senator Sanders said, climate crisis. And he was laughed off the stage by these idiot commentators. So we need a media. You need to support independent media. You need to create your own media, anti-corporate media. And you know, let's be honest here, we're facing a hijacking of our media. Have you followed Sinclair Broadcast Network? This is going to go into local communities. You need to monitor, you need to protest, you need to speak out against it. Because as Amy said, your first issue may be Medicare for all, 15 minimum. But your second better be media, because that's how people learn about these issues. And we need a media that treats seriously the movements, the ideas, the strategies, the communities trying to make a better world, and not a media which, as my colleague John Nichols has written so much about, that is obliterating the line between news and entertainment. One of his other gigs, Senator Sanders, is a great media critic. For 30 years, he's been talking about the corporatization, the conglomeratization, the Murdochization, the Breitbartization of media. We need a strategy. We have one, but let's fight hard to take back our media because it defines the reality for millions of people. So support media and onwards.
The great Amilcar Cabral, who was assassinated on the eve of his country's independence from Portuguese colonialism, when he says, "Tell no lies, claim no easy victories."
Well, thank you all for coming and being such a great audience, and this panel has been fantastic. We're talking about transformational leadership, not transactional leadership. We're talking about power, not begging for crumbs. We're talking about
demanding of the conventional media, of the mainstream media, that they start to cover some of the things that the alternative media or our regular media or our favorite media does. We need to stand up. They're not going to do it by themselves. The systems are not going to change just because we say that we need it. What we need to do is take our power and go to them and say, this is not acceptable, over and over and over again. We can't just shake our heads and say, oh, isn't this terrible? We have to use our power and make them change.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, our intern, Sherelle Withers, and I'd like to give a special thank you to Phoebe Jones of the Crossroads Women's Center in Philadelphia. She did the recording at the summit for the Sojourner Truth team. Sadly, I wasn't able to go because I was ill, so thank you so very much, Phoebe. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.